public policy realms. For example, would many people be willing to work principally at home and principally with their business associates electronically, by telephone, television, or some extensions thereof? Another question is, how much could be saved in transportation costs, both to the private citizen and to the public as a whole, if the potential for communications in the business environment were fully exploited? Another question, perhaps less often considered in this area, would be, what would be the effect on the community's financial health if many companies found they could do with considerably smaller facilities than at present? We hope that these issues will be brought up by both the speakers and you, the audience, this afternoon. That, in fact, is why we have a panel session organized, so I hope you'll all stay to discuss these issues with the speakers. And with that, I'd like to introduce the first speaker, Mr. Jim Albus from NASA headquarters. Mr. Albus received his bachelor's degree from Wheaton College in Illinois in 1957, his master's from Ohio State in 1958, and he's been at NASA since 1958. Formerly, he was the section head of Cybernetics and Subsystems Development Section at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, and now he manages NASA's Artificial Intelligence Program at NASA headquarters. Mr. Albus.
Figure out how.
This afternoon, we're going to suggest various ways that communications could substitute for transportation. I want to deal in particular with some possible alternatives to the practice of commuting to work and of the potential social and economic effects of these alternatives. In the course of my discussion, I'm going to suggest some proposals which some of you may consider to be a bit far out. Perhaps they are, but I think we need some fresh new proposals today. Many of the social problems that we face have arisen because conditions have changed. Old solutions are often inappropriate today, or they're inadequate. So my purpose this afternoon is not to present a detailed plan of action, but more to just throw out some novel ideas. If I can stimulate some of you to thinking along some new lines, I'll consider my presentation a success. If I could have the first slide, please. In the top part of this slide, we see the classical situation, the classical work situation. A worker leaves his home, and via some means of transportation, he moves his body to the work location where he performs some sort of productive work, producing goods and services, and he receives a salary. Now, in this transportation, we have the classical commuting situation, which, of course, is very expensive. It absorbs a large percentage of the total gross national product. On an individual basis, it's very expensive, particularly for the middle-class suburban dweller. Frequently, each family is required to have 2, 3, and sometimes even 4 or 5 automobiles per family. Of course, there's an enormous amount of expense in the roads and the parking facilities to service these automobiles. Commuting is quite inefficient. Many people travel 100 miles a day, spend 12 to 15 hours a week, may spend as much as $200 a month just in the act of commuting. It's a fairly wasteful operation. In some of the larger metropolitan areas, of course, we have 60% or more of the land area dedicated to automobile use, either in roads, parking facilities, service stations, and whatnot. Of course, all of this produces a great deal of air pollution, and not to mention the frustration of getting tied up in rush hour traffic. Every time you have a little snow or rain, things become extremely disturbing. Now, in the suburbs, the problem of commuting is essentially just a very expensive nuisance. But in some other areas, particularly in the ghetto areas, the problem, the cost and difficulty of getting to work is one of the major causes of unemployment. Now, down at the bottom of this slide, we have shown an alternative. The man stays either at home or near home, and via communication link, communicates with a teleoperator or industrial robot, which operating with more conventional machinery produces goods and services, and the man receives a salary. Now, we might consider just for a moment what the average person does when he's at work. Well, he receives input, he sees things, he hears things, he feels things. Generally, in your work environment, the sense of smell and taste are not usually critical. A man or a worker usually has some output. He talks or he writes. He interacts with people with facial expressions and gestures, or he manipulates objects. Now, what do we need in order to do this remotely in a system like this? Well, one of the most important things we need is a sense of presence. The man here has to feel that he is in the work environment. It has to have a very real sense of actually being there. So the video link needs to have, this camera here needs to be somehow under direction of the man, so, and perhaps even with a servo to the motions of his head, so that this camera follows his head motions and he has a sense that wherever he looks, he sees what he wants to in the remote environment. Of course, things like stereo TV and stereo earphones can create a much more compelling sense of presence. Probably the next most important thing is the dexterity of the manipulators themselves. Typical manipulators today are the type that were generated by the Atomic Energy Commission for manipulating radioactive objects. They are usually pretty crude, usually just two-finger devices. To really do any work in a reasonable general work environment, you need a five-fingered or at least a three-fingered device. In the fingers themselves, you need a sense of touch so that the operator here can actually feel things which are going on in the remote environment. This is very necessary in order to handle things like a paper or opening envelopes or handling any sort of cloth materials like that. There are, of course, a lot of experiments that are going on in this area, but so far the amount of money available for them has been quite limited. Now, probably it is also very desirable to have some sort of a computer-assisted device at this end so that the robot can actually improve on the man's dexterity and speed. Now, this has two very desirable features. One is to reduce operator fatigue, because frequently in a teleoperator situation, the operator just cannot tolerate more than a 20-minute session with the teleoperator because of the fatigue factor. So a computer-assisted device here would increase speed, which would, of course, increase productivity. The productivity increase would incidentally pay for a lot of the increased cost of the system, and it would also improve the operator fatigue. What we really need is an engineering system which looks at the entire system here and uses an optimum trade-off of what the machine can do best and what the man can do best. Generally, the man can do better than any machine we've come up with in the areas of pattern recognition, planning of the work that needs to be done, taking care of unusual circumstances. The machine, of course, can do all sorts of things, numerical control and high-speed operations. Let's now consider some examples of how a system like this would work. Video conferencing, I think, is probably one of the best examples and is going to be covered by others in this program. A second possibility is a secretarial pool. Now, this is the type of thing which could be done by just present-day technology, where you have secretaries who would be located either at or near their homes with some sort of equipment which is compatible with the telephone system. You have a job dispatcher connected to a number of business offices. Now, this has a lot of immediate advantages. One thing is that if a secretary is at home, you don't have to provide the office space. And so you have lowered rental costs in your business. This also allows for varying workloads, fluctuating workloads in the businesses. You don't have to pay the secretary unless she's actually producing work. On the secretary's end, there's a lowered cost for clothing and, of course, lower cost for transportation. Now, another benefit of this is that you can you sort of open up a completely new job market, because you can have women with small children in the home. They don't have to worry about child care. They can stay at home, take care of their children, and they can do this sort of as a part-time job. So it really opens up an entirely new field, entirely new job market. Now, there's a lot of other jobs that sort of fall into this same general category, things like billing and accounting and payroll services, and of course a lot of brokers already work in this sort of a mode. Now, I want to talk about a large-scale implementation of this type of a system for a lot of more complex things than just secretarial services. And this raises really two major problems. One is the social problem. Many people go to work for other reasons than just to make money. A lot of people go to work in order to get out of the house. And so the social acceptability of a system where you work at home would be a serious problem for many people. You go to work for the social interactions with the people that you work with. Another thing is that the more advanced system, particularly the teleoperators which can do a general type of industrial work, would be much more expensive and would require some additional cost benefits to make it worthwhile. So because of these two reasons, I'd like to consider a more general system where you have what I call remote stations. These remote stations would be located in a neighborhood, and so that, say, within walking distance of a group of 50 or 100 homes, and all the people that live in those homes then could work in the neighborhood remote control station and be within walking distance of their place of employment. These remote stations then would be connected with each other through a switching center and also with industries, which could be located anywhere the industries would choose to locate for commercial reasons. Now, a system like this then, your communication channels are amortized over a large number of workers, and you can then talk about much greater distances between the remote stations and your industries. You can start talking about microwave lengths, satellite systems, laser systems using fiber optics, and all sorts of the more esoteric communication systems. So that you can really essentially talk about economically completely separating the remote station from the industry, and you can have these things. You can have your industries in San Diego and the remote station servicing it in Maine. Now, this makes it so that the industry can locate its facilities wherever is most beneficial for shipping and receiving raw materials and shipping goods. The workers then can live in around remote stations which are optimally located for residential areas. This, of course, means that your residential areas don't need to have heavy traffic flow in them or through them. It means that they can be located in relatively unspoiled areas without the problems of pollution and industries moving in and polluting things like the forests of Maine or the deserts of Arizona or the mountains in Montana. Now, an additional benefit of this is that since these stations can essentially be located anywhere that you can put up a microwave tower, you can locate these in small towns. Of course, the salary flow then from the industry into the small town then makes small towns once again economically viable, which in today's society they are rapidly becoming economically inviable. I guess that's the right word for that. This, of course, would be a tendency to reduce urban migration and the crowding which results in the big cities and the economic decay which results in the small towns. This, of course, also makes it possible to suggest much more esoteric things, like you could take a small group of families that wishes to set up some sort of an experimental living community. Say they want to have some sort of a futuristic community. They could put a remote station in there, and they could be relatively isolated from mainstream society. You could even go backwards in time. You could get a group of people that would like to have a style of life modeled around the gay 90s, or say around colonial times. And with a remote station, you could have a horse and buggy culture, which would be economically viable, because the money would be coming into the community via salaries paid through the remote station. On a more practical basis, this sort of a system would generate a nationwide labor pool, so that the shifting employment needs would not cause regional unemployment. One of our principal problems in our present-day society, as pointed out in Toffler's book Future Shock, is the lack of roots that people have, because shifting employment needs makes it very necessary for people to move every two or three years. In many suburban communities, no one has lived there for more than 6 years, and probably no one who lives there now will live there in another 6 years. This would make it possible to change jobs by merely flicking a switch in the switching center. Now, another advantage of this is the rapid facilities for retraining workers, or training them in the first place. Here you have a worker teacher who is controlling a teleoperator robot, and the trainee can be getting a sensory feedback and really getting the feel of what the job is from the worker teacher as he acquires some skill and facility in controlling the robot. He then can control the robot, and the teacher can operate in an override capacity. The teacher, of course, doesn't need to be located anywhere near physically where the trainee is, and the teacher can train many workers at the same time. Of course, there's all sorts of educational possibilities for a system like this that one can imagine, going for adult education and even attending graduate school in distant places. Now, I've mentioned just in passing the problem of the urban ghetto. Essentially, the problem of the urban ghetto is the problem of the small town. That is, there's a lack of income coming in. This cartoon is just sort of illustrative of the one of the big problems in the ghetto. The ghetto is very isolated, and it's very expensive to get out. Particularly for low-paying jobs, it just doesn't. It's not worth going to work because it costs you more to get there than it than you get back in salary. Now this is sort of a schematic of the present system. You have your suburban residents who are relatively affluent, and they're receiving salaries from industries either in their suburban communities, or they commute into the inner city and they receive salaries. Well, the resident, that's fine for the suburban resident, except that he has a rather substantial transportation cost, and then he's also called upon to support the rural poor and the inner city poor who can't afford the transportation cost, and so the suburban resident is called upon to supply these welfare costs. Now, Jay Forrester at MIT has done some urban modeling studies on this type of a problem, and has showed that in the inner city, the real problem is not low-cost housing or job training. The problem is these inner city people just don't have any jobs, and there's no real job opportunities, and essentially the ghetto is isolated from any ability to get income coming into the ghetto itself. Now, he suggests that the solution to that is to get industry to move back in to the ghetto itself. But that raises a serious problem. Most industries have left the ghetto for very good reasons, and they're not particularly anxious to move back in. There's a serious security problem, not only for the personnel, but for the plant and the equipment, because of the, of course, crime problem in the ghetto. Now, if instead, I think I just broke the little frog here. Could I have the next slide, please? If instead we had a remote employment station, you can put the remote stations right in the ghetto areas themselves. You can also, of course, place them in the rural Appalachian regions. And so you have salary dollars now coming into the ghetto and into the rural small towns also. The industries then don't have to worry about where they locate. They can locate wherever they find it to their own benefit. Now, this doesn't necessarily imply that these remote stations have to be able to employ low-income, low-skilled people. It merely implies that any community needs income coming into it from outside. And when you have income coming into the community from outside, then that income circulates within the community, and you have a lot of low-paying, low-skilled jobs with the money that's in the community, delivery boys and grocery clerks and that sort of thing, all become viable within the community as long as the community itself has people in it which can afford to go to the grocery with something besides food stamps. Well, the question then is how to finance such a system. Could I have the next slide, please? I would suggest Probably funding is needed from two different sources, government funding and private funding. The government should support funding for research and development, should probably produce some sort of a demonstration of system feasibility, and should install some small minimal network. Private funding, of course, each industry should buy its own in-plant robots. Neighborhood job stations, I would envision being financed by some large private industry and operated on a lease basis to the local communities. And once such a system became profitable, private industry would take over the network expansion. I would sort of think that a system like this could very well develop the same way that the ComSat satellite communication system has been funded. Well, the question is, what would be the cost of such a system? In terms of dollars. Well, there's really three components. One is the computers, the other is the communication systems, and the third is the robots. Well, we all know that the price of computers is falling so rapidly that it's really difficult to predict what the cost of a small computer is going to be 10 years from now. I saw a PDP-8 over in the Coliseum for less than $4,000. Satellite and cable TV systems are already being installed, and they're proving economically feasible just for educational and entertainment uses. And already we have industrial robots, which can be purchased for about $25,000, or they can be rented for about $1.50 an hour. And the robot business is just in its infancy, and certainly at least a factor of 10 decrease in that kind of cost is feasible, and probably much more. It seems quite reasonable that the cost of one of these in-plant robots could be less than the cost of a family automobile. Now, it seems to me that certainly federal funding, if such a system as this was taken on as some sort of a national goal, could easily be at the level of a $5 billion a year if the president would decide that that was a something that a worthy national goal. Now, $5 billion a year funding could in the period of 20 years provide every neighborhood in the entire country, every neighborhood of 50 families with a remote control center stocked with $100,000 worth of equipment. Well, you might object that cost is just completely out of the ballpark, but I think you've got to look at an important economic fact. That is that a high-cost program is just the other face of a program which generates a lot of jobs. Could I have the next slide, please? Every first-year economics student has seen a chart that looks like this. Anything that costs, money flows out in terms of cost, and of course flows back in terms of income. If you don't have any costs going out, there's no salaries coming in. Money in a society really sort of obeys Kirchhoff's laws. It's a closed-loop system. Whatever you pay out in cost comes back in terms of salaries. Now, this is true of any sort of a system. It's true of the ABM system. It's true of the space shuttle. It would be true if the government decided to build pyramids. It's also true in private industry. If you build a lot of cars, it costs a lot of money, but it also creates a lot of jobs. The real question is, what do you get out of all this? The money circulating really just generates activity. And the question is whether this activity produces anything that we really want or not. And it seems to me that the question we really want to ask is, what do we want in terms of our communities? Don't we really want livable communities, that is, prosperous small towns and safe, clean cities? Don't we really want interesting jobs and a stimulating community life? Now, I maintain that a national system of robot remote employment would stimulate business and it would create jobs. Particularly, it would spur technological development in the field of electronics, communications and computers, electromechanical devices. In short, a remote jobs program would have all the economic benefits of a race to the moon, but the benefits to the average citizen would be much more immediate and direct. Remote jobs, just in summary, would reduce the frustration of commuting. It would enable people to live and work where they wish. It would bring income to depressed areas. It would reduce the destruction of the countryside and the pollution from cars and superhighways. It would utilize our immense technological capacity for meeting human needs. And I say that the result of all this could only be a return of public confidence in technology and a support for technology for years to come. Thank you. I'm not sure.
Are there any questions? We have time for one or two, and then we have to move along. Okay. Our next speaker is Mr. Alex Reed. He received his BA from Cambridge University, his master's from University College London. Currently, he is directing the Communication Study Group of the Joint Unit for Planning Research at the University College in London.
Okay, I'll do it. Well, I hope that what I have to say won't sound rather mundane after that very bold exposition we've just had. But I think that Mr. Albus would agree that there is a question of how we get from here to there, so to speak. And the work that I'd like to describe is something that's going on here and now in order to arrive at some decisions about a more modest kind of decentralization of work, namely a decentralization achieved by breaking up large organizational units into smaller units and moving those units out into regional areas. By way of background, I'd like to explain that the Communication Studies Group, for which I'm responsible, is a small interdisciplinary research group, about a dozen strong, and we're engaged in studies of the effectiveness, the acceptability, and the impact of alternative methods of person-to-person communication. Including such systems as face-to-face contact, telephone contact, and television contact. The group includes specialists in experimental social psychology, electronic engineering, operations research, and survey research. We're funded jointly by the Civil Service Department of the British Government and by the Long Range Studies Division of the British telecommunications side of the Post Office. And one of our specific tasks is to investigate the extent to which various telecommunications systems, including visual systems such as two-way television, are likely to be accepted by people as substitutes for face-to-face contact, And I think this lies at the center of the question of whether telecoms will in future substitute for travel to any significant extent. This is a subject on which I think very little is known. Nevertheless, very extreme opinions are held. On the one hand, there are people who will argue that you provide people with a two-way television link of some kind, and there you are, there's no need for them to meet each other face-to-face anymore. On the other hand, you'll find the opposite camp, which argue that there's something very magic and indefinable about face-to-face contact, and that no form of television system will substitute for it satisfactorily. Now, we reject both of those extreme positions. What we're trying to do is to find the middle course between these two extremes by means of various kinds of systematic research. This research includes laboratory experiments, some field experiments, some mathematical modeling, and also some survey research. What I'd like to concentrate on this afternoon is to say something about the survey research work. And because this part of the work has been done, carried out very closely in cooperation with the Civil Service Department as part of their interest in our work, I'd just like briefly to explain why the Civil Service Department should be interested in this kind of work. The Civil Service Department has some of the functions of the Civil Service Commission in the United States, but it's also responsible for the organization and more particularly for the location of government work. At present, the vast majority of government work of an office kind is concentrated in central London. This has given, over the years, it's given rise to suggestions that there'd be great both savings of cost and also various social and political benefits if this work were decentralized in a large way out to regional or rural areas. And I think we've heard just now some of the kind of benefits you could get out of that sort of decentralization. Now, this study, which is quite a large-scale exercise, of which our work only forms a small part, has come to the conclusion that if you look at a situation where there is a large concentration of jobs in a city such as London, and you examine the pros and cons of moving that work out to regional locations, that all the costs, the social costs and the economic costs, argue in favor of an outward move of this work. There are obvious savings in rent and in salary costs and in the journey to work. There are advantages from the point of view of the employees in terms of improved amenity, cheaper housing, and so on. But on the other hand, there is this big question of the damage that you might inflict on communications within the organization if you were to make this kind of move. And the government study that we're working with has come to the conclusion that really the only major disadvantage to this sort of decentralization rests in this possible damage to efficiency through greater difficulty of communication between these separated units. And in particular, to the greater difficulty of face-to-face communication, insofar as other forms of communication can quite readily be conducted over a distance. Well, the way that this exercise is being tackled is to break up the work presently concentrated in government in London, and I'm speaking of about 100,000 jobs, to break this up into a couple of hundred self-contained blocks of work. These are defined as units of anything from a dozen to a couple of hundred people, which are seen organizationally as an indivisible block, which would have to move en bloc if it were to move. Then a number of potential receiving locations have been identified at different points in the country, and a good deal of information has been obtained about these in terms of the economic and social benefit you would get by moving a single job to that particular location. The next stage, which is where it comes into the communications aspect, is that the frequency of face-to-face contact between each block and every other block has been surveyed by means of quite an elaborate questionnaire exercise in which each of these civil servants has been asked to estimate how frequently he has face-to-face contact with each of these other blocks of work and also with other fixed locations outside the government sector. There's then been developed a computer model using a branch and bound algorithm, which explores all the possible permutations and combinations of relocation of these blocks to one or more of these potential receiving locations. And for each of these complex location strategies, it evaluates both the savings that would arise in terms of economic savings and also social benefits through reduction of unemployment in particular areas of the country. It identifies the benefits, that is to say, but it also totals up the amount of communications damage that would be expected to arise from that particular relocation strategy. And this communications damage is a measure derived from the frequency of face-to-face contact between every block and its, the other blocks with which it communicates, multiplied by the salary of the people involved, and multiplied by some function of distance in order to take into account the relative difficulty of communicating at different distances. The role of the decision maker in this exercise is then to balance off the costs and benefits by adopting some weighting between money and communications damage. And in the ultimate, the decision of how much decentralization occurs is left to the decision maker and is a political decision based on his relative evaluation of these two measures. However, the model does, I think, make the assumptions that are involved in such an exercise overt. It ranks alternative solutions in some sensible order, and it forces on the decision maker some consistency as between decisions regarding one department and decisions regarding another. Well, there's the background to the Civil Service Department study in which this communication survey work plays a part. And the reason it plays a part is that against the background of that sort of model, you will see that insofar as telecommunications could substitute for some of these face-to-face contacts, that this would have an extremely important effect in two ways. Firstly, it would have an effect on the kind of relocation strategy that should be adopted, in the sense that any substitution would imply a greater degree of decentralization, either in terms of greater number of people or greater distance or both. And also, when it comes to implementing a relocation of this kind, it'll be necessary for the government to decide what kinds of telecommunications equipment and how much telecommunications equipment should be provided to these people in order to overcome the disadvantages of separation. And it's one of the jobs of my group is to determine for the Civil Service Department how many of these face-to-face contacts could successfully be transferred to particular kinds of telecommunication system. I forgive me if this sounds rather a long and detailed exposition of a specialized piece of work, but I think the methods that are being used are much more generally applicable in the business sector and in other countries. Well, now, how are we going about this question of determining the substitutability of these meetings? We're engaged in a number of activities, as I mentioned, and I'd like very briefly to say something about each of them before we get on to talk about the results of this communication survey activity. Let me just test. Fine. Could we have the first slide, please? Well, the first kind of activity in which we're engaged is laboratory experiments, in which we bring together pairs or groups of people, and we have them carry out communication tasks of different kinds, either via telecommunications or face-to-face. And we then take numerous measures of this process and try to analyze, so far as we can, the differences there are between communication via, for example, telephone or television, and communication face-to-face. Because, as I mentioned, this is a thing that there's a lot of preconception about, but I think there's very little objective information on it. Well, what we do is we have these two telecommunications rooms in the laboratory so that participants can communicate either by television or voice or both between these two. We have a face-to-face room where they can converse across a table, and a monitoring space where we record their conversations on tape. This diagram, please don't bother to try and read the text, indicates some of the kinds of measures that we take in these laboratory experiments. Firstly, we take various measures of overt behavior. That is to say, we measure the task performance of the participants. These measures of overt behavior are represented by the black arrows there. Task performance, for example, the time that people take to reach an agreement if it's a negotiating task, the quality of the solution they reach in a problem-solving task, for example, the extent to which they reach agreement and change their point of view, and the extent to which they form clear impressions of the other party. There are a whole variety of task performance measures which you can take depending on the particular exercise that's under investigation. We also study the discussion content. That is to say, we transcribe these tape recordings and look at the frequency with which people put forward suggestions, the extent to which the conversation is shared between the participants, or whether it's dominated by one, and so on. We also are hoping soon to start looking at speech patterns in a detailed sense, to look at things like the lengths of hesitations and simultaneous speech, and the relative lengths of utterances by the different participants. And one could also take measures of nonverbal behavior, such as a gaze, direction, gestures, and so on, although we're not yet working in that area. Secondly, we're taking measures of attitudes. These are represented by the arrows here. The attitudes of each participant, both to the medium of communication and also to the other party in the communication. This is subjective information elicited generally by rating scales. Well, I'd be glad to answer any questions about this laboratory work, but I think we should really move on from it and mention that a second part of the work involves some field experiments. If I could have the next slide, please. One of these is a field trial of an audio conference system which provides automatic identification of the remote speakers. That's to say that around this table there are a number of positions which can be occupied by people at your location, and the people at the remote location are represented by these units here, which incorporate a loudspeaker, a lamp, and a nameplate. And by automatic voice switching and multiplexing the utterances across a single telephone channel, we can reproduce to some extent the sensations of around the table group discussion with individual people's utterances coming from their correct position around the table. That is currently operating between London and Edinburgh in a field trial over a distance of about 400 miles. The other field trial in which we're engaged is of a conventional two-way video system between two government buildings in central London. I won't bother to dwell on that, except to say that in both these trials we'll be interviewing the participants to discover to what extent they feel these kind of systems, both video and audio, to be satisfactory substitutes for face-to-face contact. A third part of the work involves, this is just a slide I put in to show the British Post Office's Confravision system, which is a two-way television system now marketed between five cities in the United Kingdom. And we're watching the launching of that with great interest. It's just been offered for about 4 months now. Well, a third part of our work involves cost studies and mathematical modeling of costs and firms' communication behavior. I don't want to say anything about this in detail, except just to flash up a couple of slides which will illustrate the sort of things we're looking at. This is a slide showing the travel cost distances of various cities from one city in the United Kingdom. That's to say that these black dots represent these towns here, repositioned so that their distance is proportional to the cost of traveling to this central town of Birmingham. And you'll notice that in the case of London, its effective distance is less than its real distance because of good communications, whereas in other cases, the effective distance is much greater than the geographical one. If you compare that with the cost of telecommunication, you notice, of course, that this is telephone costs here, that it is much shorter, that's to say the costs are much less, but more particularly, it's a great leveler, that is to say, because of the tariff structure, it makes all other cities more or less equidistant with any particular central city that you choose. What I'd like to talk about, though, in the 10 minutes or so remaining to me, is the communication survey work in which we're engaged. The study that I'd like to describe was done within government. It involved the participation of about 6,500 middle and senior level civil servants, and each of them was asked to complete this questionnaire, which is just a kind of folded foolscap sheet of paper. In it, they were asked to describe in detail one specific face-to-face meeting in which they had taken part. That's to say, they were given a start time and told to record the first meeting after that start time, these start times being staggered through the day and through the week in order to get some representative sampling. What I'd like to do is to put the emphasis now on describing the method here and some of the implications. If any of you should be interested in the detailed results of this exercise, you'd be most welcome to write to us and we'd be happy to send you material on it. This questionnaire, I'm sorry, could we go back? That wasn't really a click. This questionnaire is designed to a considerable extent on the basis of previous work in Sweden and also in London on surveying office communication patterns. What it does is to get at, in the first instance, some straight factual information about the contact. Down here we ask people how many people took part, how long it lasted, to what extent was it prearranged, how well did the people know each other, and so on. Quite clear-cut factual information. The key question really is this one up here, which says to people, Could you have carried out this face-to-face contact over the telephone? And if not, why not? And we then have a number of responses they can give, including such ones as the telephone would have made it difficult for a group of people to take part, would have made it difficult or impossible to exchange documents, would have been less persuasive, less friendly, would have been less secure, and so on. And of course, not surprisingly, we find that the vast majority, about 95% of people, say that it would not have been possible to do this over the telephone. And we are analyzing their responses to that question in order to determine what kind of a telecommunication system might have been appropriate if that contact had been transferred from face-to-face to telecommunications. Then on the rest of the form, we ask for a description of the general purpose, the main feature of the meeting, an open-ended question to describe the who was there and the topic of what was discussed, and then some information at the bottom here on the travel particulars for those people who traveled to take part in the meeting. I think I should admit that this form was not as thoroughly pre-tested as we would have liked, because this information has to be gathered in order to be fed into the government study on a rather tight timescale. But we are, in fact, at the moment embarking for the British Post Office on a methodological study evaluating different methods of communication survey. That's to say, comparing the accuracy and acceptability of questionnaires of different length and different duration of recording period. Because as you'll appreciate, this was each person was only asked to record one contact. You can, of course, distribute to fewer people and ask them each to record a greater number, and there's trade-offs all along the scale there. The reason, in fact, that we did it this way is that there was another questionnaire going out to all these people, asking them, as I mentioned, to estimate their detailed frequency of contact with each of the other blocks of work. And so this questionnaire was able to ride piggyback on that other questionnaire, so we had a low-cost method of getting it out to everybody. Well, I'd like to now turn to discuss some of the results that we got out of this. The first point I ought to make is the response was virtually 100% because there was an official requirement to complete this form in connection with the government study. And I believe that civil servants are also considerably more amenable to this kind of exercise than, say, people in private industry would be. Now, only about 65% of respondents did have a face-to-face contact in the specified week, which was what we expected. And so out of 10,000 people to whom this form was distributed, we got about 6,400 usable responses. Now, out of that, we got, of course, factual distributions on such things as the number of participants in meetings, the duration of meetings, to what extent they were prearranged, and so on. And this is very useful information for our cost studies because, of course, the cost of a face-to-face meeting is largely independent of the duration of it, insofar as it's a fixed cost attributable to the trip involved, whereas the cost of telecommunication systems generally vary more or less linearly with the duration for which they're used. But the thing I'd like to discuss, if I may, is these responses we got on the more subjective questions of whether people would have, what sort of systems people would have required to do this by telecommunications. Well, on that question 7, which gave them the various alternatives that they could respond to, this was the kind of picture that we got in terms of their primary reasons. I should explain, they were asked to give both a primary reason of why the telephone would have been inadequate, and they could also check as many secondary reasons as they wished as also applying. And what came out top of this, as you'll see, was the need for groups to take part. By far the most frequently cited primary reason was that the telephone would have been inadequate because it wouldn't have satisfactorily enabled a group of people to take part. The second one was this one of documents, the need to exchange, consult, and sign documents. The third one, these are just shorthand labels, but the third one was the need to gather background information. Now, this is a very ambiguous kind of expression, and we're doing some further work on it. But our present interpretation of it is that to gather background information refers to those kind of activities before and after and around the face-to-face meeting, the informal communication of picking up bits and pieces of gossip and information, the kind of thing which is probably difficult to capture on a telecommunications system. Then we had two reasons which we thought implied the need for a visual channel, that's to say the desire to assess the other person's reactions and the desire to exercise persuasion. Both of those rated quite low, as did these other reasons, the need for security, the desire to maintain friendly relations, reasons of courtesy, and also we did put in a reason of saying that they would felt the handset telephone was inconvenient to hold for a long meeting. That didn't strike up very high as a response. But I'd like to just refine this a little, if I may. What we found when we looked at the secondary reasons is that this bald table here does break down into two subcategories. That's to say that these reasons of groups, documents, and security come out as what we term critical reasons. That is to say that when they are mentioned, they are frequently mentioned as the most important reason. Now, on the other hand, these other reasons, particularly background, but also the other reasons, are frequently mentioned as secondary reasons. They're what one might think of as rather soft reasons, i.e. people tend to kind of tick them as a secondary reason which applied, but only rather seldom do they regard this as the key reason why they couldn't have have conducted this over the telephone. What we are then doing is, on the basis both of the factual information about the meetings and on the basis of this subjective information, to allocate these contacts to alternative telecommunications systems. And for this purpose, we've hypothesized three simple packages, each of which are readily available on the market at the moment. One is what we call the T package, namely just the ordinary telephone. The second is what we call the 4T package, i.e. something costing around four times as much as a telephone, which one might expect to provide high-fidelity two-way sound, document transmission, security, and facilities for a group of people to take part. And then we hypothesize what we call a 16T system, i.e. a system costing something of the order of 16 times as much as a telephone, providing full two-way television, as in picture phone or the post office ConfraVision system. And what we then do is to assign these face-to-face contacts to those various categories according to whether we feel that the responses of the people indicate that they required those particular kind of systems. Now, if we pay attention only to the people's primary reasons, I do hope you'll be able to read this. I'm afraid it's not a very well-drawn chart. But the top part of it here shows the responses for the total and then for four separate departments. But I think the only point of that really is to show that the variations between departments are comparatively small. I think we might stay here with this left-hand bar representing the total of all 6,500 contacts. Now, what you'll see is that if we assign on the basis of the primary reasons, we get a substantial proportion here in the face-to-face category, around 45% still considered to require face-to-face contact. We then get also a substantial proportion of around 40 to 50%, which we feel could be satisfactorily accommodated by means of a audio plus graphics group communication facility of some kind, costing around four times as much as a telephone. We have a comparatively small proportion, which we find assigned to the two-way television kind of systems, and a very small proportion on the telephone, who reckon they could do it satisfactorily on the telephone. I think the main importance of this, to my mind, is to suggest that this area of what one might call the 4T systems has been rather a neglected one, and that it's something that people might well find useful as a substitute for current business meetings. Now, if we vary one of our assumptions and pay attention also to people's secondary reasons, the extreme case of which is to give equal weight to secondary reasons as to primary reasons, we get the kind of picture that you see in the bottom here. That is to say that there is a very big transfer of contacts from the 4T category to the face-to-face category due to the fact that they're having checked background information as a secondary reason puts them up into a face-to-face contact if you pay attention to that secondary reason. However, this does largely entirely bypass the 16T category, and it still remains a small one. My own feeling is that the right picture lies somewhere in between these two diagrams that we have on the board. There are, however, some very important unanswered questions which I wouldn't like to ignore. One is that we are assuming that this question of background information is something that requires face-to-face contact. If television systems can give people this sort of facility, it alters the distribution. We're also assuming that groups of people can be satisfactorily accommodated on an audio system. This is something, of course, also that absolutely remains to be demonstrated. The final thing I'd like to say is that these calculations are, of course, based on very particular circumstances of this government study in London. I wouldn't like to generalize from those results. What I'd like to do, I think, is to suggest that this kind of rather detailed study of the communication process as it at present occurs and of people's expressed needs for particular kinds of systems is a good basis on which to build up some information on the potential substitutability of face-to-face contacts by telecommunications. Thank you.
Any attempt to correlate age and therefore, you know, young guys are used to working with telephones all the time, and therefore will put up with a telephone? Anything that you found along these lines?
The laboratory, can you hear me all right without the apparatus? The laboratory work is being carried out on middle-level and senior-level civil servants. Because they are the population in whom we're primarily interested in this exercise, and so we're not studying the age variable there. We haven't yet got into after studies on the field experiments, but I think we would certainly expect to find some age differences there. I mean, just a kind of off the top of the head basis, I'd say that we do find that younger people are readier to have a crack at this new way of communicating rather than older people. We'd obviously be very much interested in this. As far as the statistical exercise, the survey operation is concerned, we have analyzed some of the data by status or salary, which is roughly equivalent to age in civil service. And of course, we find very important variations in the amount of communication that they generate, and also some systematic variations in the type of communication they generate. However, the age is, of course, heavily confounded with status and with job type, and I think it'd be very dangerous to attribute any direct difference to age there.
One more. Thanks, Sheldon. I've found in U.S. and British civil service organizations that chance meetings between people, particularly at different ranks, often produce a significant transfer of information, lunch, that sort of thing. Does your study look at that?
Well, I ought to explain that the statistical exercise asked people to record all contacts of above 5 minutes duration. And so, I mean, literally just a word exchanged in a corridor wouldn't come through in that survey. But on the other hand, we didn't say that this does not refer just to formal meetings. I mean, this could be a 5 or 10 minutes conversation in a canteen, so long as it's related to a work topic. Yes, I am personally very much persuaded of the point you make there. I believe that this kind of informal chance contact is extremely important. And I think it's something which it's going to be extremely difficult to cater for with telecommunications.
What technology corresponds to this 4T, four times the cost of telephone?
I think I see the 4T as the involving just a more imaginative use of our existing network. That's to say, the use either of voice channels or possibly of 48 kilohertz channels, but putting onto the end of those channels a more ingenious variety of terminals, many of which are already available off the shelf, facsimile, slow scan graphics, high fidelity loudspeaking sound, and perhaps some automatic identification of speakers for group meetings of the kind that I indicated. But I think that when I say that it's a neglected area, I think that the need is not for technological breakthroughs there. I think it's in just the application of existing technology.
Could it be that the choice of various people that you interviewed questioned was influenced by the cost of the medium that you suggested? Like Garcia, someone who said, boy, it's about 16 times as much.
That does raise a very important point, and it raises an interesting distinction, I think, between this approach and some other similar work. We did not ask people, do you think that you would need a 16T or a 4T system, or do you think you'd need television or whatever? We said to them, why do you think you couldn't have done this over a telephone? Now, and we gave these reasons, some of which were, as it were, very expensive reasons, some of which were cheap reasons. But this was not explained to them at all, and by and large, I don't think they're aware of this. And so I think that when somebody checked that he needed to exchange documents, it wasn't in any sense because he was aware that was a comparatively cheap thing to do.
I think we'll have to move.
We'll now hear from Mr. Arthur Williams, the Bell Telephone Laboratories in Homedale, New Jersey. He's going to speak to us on video conferencing. Mr. Williams received both his BS and MS degrees from Rutgers University, and he's been at Bell Labs since 1955, and his current assignment is is doing systems planning for video telephone service. Mr. Williams. Let's see if we can get this on you.
Mm-hmm. Well.
That's rather frightening. It seems that as we go from speaker to speaker, we're getting down to less grandiose schemes. And I'm really going to talk about something which, compared to the elegance of what I've heard so far, first of all, is a 16T system. And, I hope it's 16T. And secondly, is really a rather simple-minded problem that I want to discuss. And it's really the problem of how you arrange a number of television cameras, a number of monitors, a number of chairs, and a table in a room so that groups of individuals can confer with one another. And I'll be talking from a set of slides, and I'll probably fall over this thing. And I'm glad that guy didn't break this. Okay. The experiment actually has, that I'm going to talk about, has two phases. The first phase is actually over. And it was an experiment to do group conferencing using commercial TV standards. And by commercial TV standards, I mean the kind of thing you receive in your home, 525 lines, a 4-megacycle signal. And the second phase, the one that's currently underway, is a test attempting to see if we can really do the same experiment using video telephone standards. And by video telephone standards, I mean the so-called picture phone standards at the Bell System picture phone service that the Bell System is now offering in a number of places. And in contrast to the commercial TV system, this is a 1-megacycle system. The picture has something like 267 lines as opposed to 525 lines. Most of what I say, by the way, applies to both systems because the general objectives, the general way of doing things has been the same for both experiments. The objectives of the experiment were, there's actually three of them, and they were to investigate the subjective and technical feasibilities of group conferencing, but also to look at the economics of group conferencing. And while I don't have detailed results to give you about economics, it was the economic factor which made us go from doing the experiment on 4-megacycle standards to doing it on a 1-megacycle standards. I should also say that the particular objectives of exploring video conferencing were really to look at the particular kind of video conferencing that we attempted to implement at the Bell Laboratories. You saw the very briefly the British ContraVision system. There are a number of systems that predate ours by quite a bit. And the unique feature about ours is that we used the voice switching, the voice control of cameras to select the picture that was being sent from the particular terminal that I'm talking about, or the particular room. And this is really the most salient difference between the group conference experiment that I'm talking about and any of the other systems you've seen. I should also point out, after having seen that rather nice picture of the ContraVision system, that the work we're doing is purely experimental. And so the television monitors that you see will be on plain pipe racks and will not be done over in mahogany or whatever it was that must cost quite a bit. Okay. We started out with a set of requirements or objectives that we had for a video conference room. This is really kind of looking at it from the, I guess I can move off of here, can I? From the user's point of view. We felt it should be simple and natural to use. I just went through a thing where a designer wanted to solve the problems we have with microphone pickup by hanging a microphone around people's necks, and I kind of objected to that because that's, I don't think, is a good idea. We felt you should have hands-free operation, and I'm really talking in this sense about not having a lot of controls for the individual to operate, and also that the audio performance should be natural. The guy should not have to push any buttons or do anything to make it easy to use. No technicians during the conference is probably self-explanatory. In a business conference, you don't want to have a cameraman or other individuals around to disturb the conference. There should be a clear portrayal of conferees. And I should point out that that really implies that you want to have good conferencing between the two rooms equipped for conferencing, but you also want to be able to have a good conference within the room. I think if you're not careful, you can get the kind of atmosphere where it appears that the conferees in this room are lined up on a table like this, and they're staring at a television monitor in a similar room, and it seems to me it would be fairly easy to get the impression that this room was competing in some way against the other room, and so we've tried to avoid that. The final one is related really to a point that Mr. Reed made, and that is that people conferring, wanting to talk to one another, wanting to have a business conference, also have the need to transmit graphic material. And so we wanted to make provision in this room for good graphics. And with this as the starting point, my next rather grotesque slide shows the resulting room that we came up with. And never had so many gadgets to play with in my life. That is obscene. Well, anyway, let me explain how the room works by kind of going through the thing that somebody would have to go through to use the room. Now, this particular room has three positions in it. The positions are really indicated by the monitors in front of a position. The room is shown here with three chairs at the table, the microphone, which picks up the voice of the speaker and actuates some equipment that's off in the back room, the cameras on top of the television monitors, and let me just describe this monitor. The near monitors are used to display the signal from the incoming room. The overview monitor, this really not a good name for it, it's actually a far monitor, is used to display the signal that is being sent from this room. And what happens when you have the conferees in the normal mode of operation and sitting around the table is that an individual will speak at this position, his voice will be picked up, and that camera, the signal from that camera, will be sent to the other room. At the same time, this camera, or this monitor rather, will show the picture being sent, and people who are off camera can get back on camera and can be assured that the system is in fact working. Now, it took us about a year, actually, to get the room into this shape, and by shape I mean the different modes that we had to put into the system so that it would work satisfactorily and people would be happy using it. And one thing we found, if you just provided the three near monitors here and even the overview monitor, that if everyone were silent in this room for a period of time, the people in the other room were getting a picture of merely the last talker, or the last three people in the room. And this tended to make them unhappy, and it also tended to make the individual who was sitting here, always on camera, rather unhappy. And since that wasn't our goal, particularly, we built, I should point out that a lot of other people did the work. Very little of what I show here I did, and I'll identify some of the people later. But a circuit was built into this equipment, which you cannot see on this drawing, that during periods of silence from this room, when everybody was silent, this so-called overview camera came on, and it was really a wide-angle shot of the entire room. And with that camera being on, nobody was particularly on camera or felt that they were the center of attraction. You'll see something labeled cough button right there. You can imagine in a conference if people are talking, you felt like coughing or sneezing, that to have your picture suddenly appear would be somewhat undesirable. So we built into the room the ability to turn off the voice voting so that if you had to make a side remark or cough or do something like that, you weren't on television doing it. Now, I'm going to show a slide showing a picture of this particular room, and it's taken just about, if it's in the machine right, from this direction, and it's actually the physical arrangement of equipment that is shown on this layout. Okay. This is the room, and I think you can see the monitors on the plain pipe racks, which got me upset. This is a picture being sent from this room of the overview camera, this particular camera, and you can see, perhaps you can see if you have a good imagination, that it takes in the entire room. Now, the individuals see the incoming picture on these far monitors. This gentleman sitting here is back out in the audience somewhere, and his name is Doran Mitchell, and I must give him credit. He's the one that got the first part of this system going and evolved just what you see in this room. And here he's using it, having a business conference with individuals at Homedel. By the way, I should say that we have two of these rooms in operation. One is in the Bell Laboratories location in Murray Hill, New Jersey, and the other one is in Homedel, New Jersey, and they're separated by about 30 miles, and we have a microwave circuit between the two locations. The only individual in this conference environment here that has any controls to operate at all is the man in the center position, and he has two sets of controls that he has to operate. The first one here allows him to select either this voice-switched mode of operation, or if he wishes to show graphic material, he presses a button here, and then we have, and I'll show this later, a graphics camera on the ceiling that's focused on the table, and he's able to show graphic material from this location. For those of you who like block diagrams and circuitry, this is a block diagram of the system showing the voice voting circuit, the audio system, the video switch, and the interconnection of components. For the video system, we used standard commercial kind of TV facilities and four-wire private line audio facilities. For the picture phone system, we used two directions of video transmission and a two-wire audio facility. I think I've broken it also. Okay. Now, really, this is really simply just another view of the room, and I believe this is the Homedel room. And one of the things we're really trying to do here is to satisfy people, and a number of people felt that this particular arrangement of tables was unsatisfactory and that we ought to try some other things. And after a great deal of thinking, we did come up with some other alternatives, that one other alternative that you see. The problem here was it was felt that these two individuals would feel rather remote and have no good rapport with the people at the other end of the table. Well, there is Paul Reed, and he designed the voice voting circuitry, which makes this whole thing work. And I'm probably not doing justice to that circuitry because there's a lot of features in it which make this video conferencing a viable, useful medium. For instance, there has to be sufficient delays built into the voice switching so that the cameras are not just joggling back and forth at the slightest utterance. And also, you really want it to stay on an individual for a while. Otherwise, you'd have kind of a chaotic situation. This is the kind of display you would see on the screen. It doesn't look like it's focused too well, but this shows three individuals taking part in a conference. One thing that we found was that, I'm sorry, one thing we found that individuals, at least within the laboratories where we try to evaluate this system, very quickly adopted to the video mechanism and were not conscious of that they were on television and found it quite viable and used it quite frequently. The only thing I might point out is that they do look rather relaxed, and indeed that's what we found that was what our experience was with the individuals who used it. Now, our method of evaluation of this conference system was basically one of advertising it throughout the laboratories for the use of the engineers or on a daily basis or whenever they wanted to use it. And in an attempt to evaluate it, why we did some things similar to that you might imagine. We interviewed the participants, we asked them questions, and the next slide shows the quality rating that we got using a 4-point rating scale. And it was actually a very favorable response. Something like 98% of the individuals who used the system said it was good or better. Perhaps they were just being kind to us, and perhaps the Bell Laboratories engineers are a kind audience, but I don't think that's necessarily true. I was reading something the other night where an individual had done a later survey after the formal phase of this experiment, and he was quoting numbers like 76% of the people were saying it was good or better, and some small percentage were saying it was less than poor. But those results did not turn up during our more formal trial of this system. Now, we also, and since the subject today is the substitution of communications for travel, we also asked the individuals using the system to give us some rating of how far they would travel in preference to using the system, or how much time it would have to take for a conference before they would use the system. And the next chart shows that kind of thing. I don't know if you can read it, but very, very generally, it should say that something like 50% of the people would travel, I don't know, it looks like 15 miles rather than use the system, and something like 90% of them would use the system if the trip was 50 miles or more. In the same way, we asked them their preference for travel time versus using the system, and I don't know, something like 50% again would use the system if it were if they had to travel more than a half an hour to get from one point to another. Now, it's on data like this that we really reached the conclusion that group conferencing, video conferencing, by this voice switching technique was viable. Not only that, but when we tried to turn the system down because we had reached the conclusions we wanted to, our staff area and the people who'd been using it decided that they didn't want this and they would like the thing to keep going. And so in point of fact, even though the formal experimental phase of the 4-megacycle group conferencing system is over, the system is still in operation, and indeed they're talking about extending video conference rooms like this to other laboratories locations and perhaps to some AT&T locations. However, when you begin to look into the economics of the situation, you find that 4-megacycle video circuits are somewhat expensive, and so you want to cast around perhaps and find some other alternatives. And if I may have the next slide. There are really two choices that you might consider at the present time. One is the 4-megacycle closed-circuit TV approach that we took initially, and it does have many advantages. It has highly developed terminals. It has there are broadcast TV facilities all over the country. It is a limited network, and transmission is expensive, and so we tried to find other alternatives that gave promise of alleviating some of these difficulties. And one thing that came to our mind, being in the video systems planning area, picture phone planning area, was to try and use the picture phone network and the picture phone approach to group conferencing. And it seemed to us to have a number of advantages, and let me just tell you what they are. First of all, if as picture phone develops, it will be generally available. It will be on a switch two-way network so that if you wanted to have a conference, you could imagine dialing up the circuit instead of always having it. And that reflects itself, of course, in lower transmission costs. The penalty you have to pay, and the thing that really makes this a separate experiment from the other, is that the graphic capability of picture phone is not as great as standard television. Now, standard television, as I mentioned earlier, has 525 lines, has a 4-megacycle bandwidth, has a 4-to-3 aspect ratio. And you can see about a half a page of typewritten material. Picture phone has a 1 megacycle bandwidth. It has this 267 lines. It has an aspect ratio that's almost square. And you cannot see a full, or rather a half page of typing. What you can do with magnification and zoom lenses and things is to see about a 2 or 3 inch swath of typing. And whether or not that'll be adequate for having business conferences is something that we're in the process of exploring. Now, the first thing we did when we started the picture phone experiment was to literally do over the video conference system on picture phone standards using large screen monitors. We did start out with a different arrangement of table and furniture. And if I can have the next slide. This is a room very similar to the rooms I've shown previously. The only difference is that the system is now working on the 1 megacycle picture phone signal standards. It operates basically the same way. We do here, however, have a telephone or a telephone key set that we can access any of the other picture phone stations on our corporate network or any other room associated or equipped like this. These things that perhaps look like flying saucers here are the loudspeakers from an audio conference system that we've used along with the video conference system. And you can also see up here the overhead graphic camera that focuses down on the table. You can see an individual discussing a bit of graphic material with someone else. There was one thing I did not point out about the operation of the either the video system or this one, and that is, since you also desire the participants in this room to be able to see the graphic material, we arranged the switching system so that when graphics is being transmitted from this room, the graphic material also appears on what I call the near monitors. Okay? Now, the final, I have two more view graphs. We do not have two of these rooms in operation at the present time, but we did run a series of business games. At least the human factors people associated with us on this project ran a series of business games using this room and a one position room. And the results of that, the quality rating of that system are shown on the next view graph. And if you'll notice, the ratings that we obtained with the picture phone system are a little bit lower than with the video conference system. Instead of having 98% good or better, we have something like 64% good or better and 34% saying it's fair. Now, the present state of the experiment is one of equipping additional rooms so that we can evaluate the system in actual use, and also one of trying to look at the use of the standard picture phone set instead of the large screen monitors, so that the present version of that room looks as it's shown in the next slide. And this is one of the earlier versions of the room arrangement. We currently have a slightly larger table, but this is the standard, commercially available, if you will, picture phone set taken off its base, mounted on the table, pointing at the conferees. And what we're going to do now is equip additional rooms like this and find out if people can indeed have group conferencing using the picture phone system. I think I'll stop. Thank you.
Anybody want to address a question, Mr. Williams?
There's one, two, three, four.
Gentlemen back there.
Mr. Mitchell, sir. It's not a commercial.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if they, did you all hear that? What he said was that, well, he didn't say what I said. What he said was that the graphics, admittedly, are in trouble, and that this was okay because there are many new technologies coming along, slow scan systems, other systems that will provide a good graphic capability to the picture, the basic picture phone system. And I think that's perfectly correct. When you have a picture phone call established like this, you will have a 1 megacycle, basically a 1 megacycle network between the two points. And so using some of the developments that he sees in the future, the graphic capability can be indeed taken care of by other adjuncts. Do you want to, you do that.
Is the inability of the conferee in location A to take a piece of paper and hand it to a fellow conferee in location B for his evaluation. It's often desirable to do this sort of thing. Have you considered setting up the conference setup here with some sort of a fax or similar device where hard copy in location A can be inserted and received in location B?
Yes, that's a perfectly viable thing that you could do to this room. Very early in the picture phone experiment, we did attempt to back it up with a facsimile system. Unfortunately, the one we chose to use took 6 minutes to get the picture from one point to another. And people who wanted to discuss something did not want to wait 6 minutes for it to get to the other end. So, but there are other alternatives, and I think it's a viable one. You don't have to wait 6 minutes. There are certain people within the laboratories who always go in that room and say, my goodness, when are you going to have it in color? They do it 100% of the time. They're about 1% of the people. He's sitting there. The second thing about special clothing, there is no need in this environment to use special clothing. If the cameras are misadjusted, a white shirt sometimes causes problems, but there is no reason that you couldn't wear anything you wanted to wear. Also, somewhere in the order of 4 or 5% of the people who did comment on open-ended questionnaires suggested they might like to have color. But it's not a large, it's not a strong demand at the present time. Or it doesn't seem to be. Oh, do you want to cut them off or something?
Okay, yeah.
The answer to the second question is yes. The answer to the first question is that there are 250 active vertical lines in a picture phone, in the picture phone signal format, and the vertical resolution is 7/10 or whatever you choose to use as a Kell factor. Okay. Okay.
Okay. I'd like to defer any more questions to the answer.
How do I escape? Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, next we'll hear from Mr. Sid Polk from MITRE Corporation, who is going to give us some other practical discussion on some more of practical work he's been doing. Mr. Polk received his bachelor's from Purdue and his master's from Penn. He was with Bell Telephone Laboratories from 1963 to 68, and since 68 he's been with MITRE in Arlington, in McLean, Virginia.
Can I have the first slide, please? I'm going to be discussing work which was done substantially by two departments at MITRE. I'm going to be talking about some new techniques for using computers with cable television. Can I have the next slide, please? I'd like to discuss with you today some of the services that can be made available through the use of computers and cable television. I'd like to show, primarily by means of a short film towards the end of this talk today, I'd like to show you what we're doing at Reston in the way of demonstrating what you can do with computers and cable television. To get at this, I'd like to describe in a tutorial manner a little bit of what cable television has to offer today and what it's going to offer in the very near future. Finally, with respect to our demonstration in Reston, Virginia, I'd like to speculate a little bit on what people have said they're willing to pay based on an informal survey that we've conducted in Reston. And I'd also like to mention a few of the barriers we see in the way of this particular system coming into our everyday life. Could I have the next slide, please? This is illustrative of some of the services that could be provided through the use of computers and cable television. Relative to working at home, perhaps we can provide with computers and cable television access to company files to allow you to do work at home. Cable television is currently used as an entertainment medium. Through the use of computers and through a means that I'd rather not get into now, but we're not going to take that so-called free television and make it pay television, but different forms of television can be made available through cable TV, through the use of the computer as some form of billing mechanism. There are a variety of health services that could be made available, such as diagnosis in the home or certain outpatient services, where the conventional home TV set is the home terminal, the TV set that, say in Washington, D.C., some 98% of the people do presently have in their home. With respect to education, bringing the courses into the home. Again, this was just illustrative of a number of the services that could be provided. We're demonstrating some of these services currently in Reston, and the film will show you sort of a fast glimpse through a variety of the services that we're providing. Could I have the next slide, please? For the purposes of this talk, I've chosen to describe the cable TV services into two major classes, one way and two way. On this slide, I'm showing three subclasses of one way: conventional one way, special one way, and dynamic addressing. The special hardware is primarily terminal hardware, hardware in the home. For the case of conventional one way cable television, one can provide more channels today, on the order of perhaps 20 channels, where in the past it's typically been about 12 channels, primarily the same sort of entertainment that's been offered over the air. I'd like to highlight dynamic addressing. In dynamic addressing, with the computer located at a central point, the subscriber having a TV set in his home, the subscriber is able to dynamically change the address of his own home. What he does, as far as the computer is concerned, he changes the address that the computer sees at this man's particular home. The computer sends down the communications path, a cable, television-like pictures. Conventional television sends 60 fields per second. For our purposes here, I want to call the fields frames, forgetting about interlays. So if you can picture 60 frames per second being sent down to the subscriber's home, the subscriber in his home has a device called a frame grabber, sometimes called a frame stopper, frame freezer, and a decoder. The frame grabber is a video refresh device. It has the capability of grabbing or stopping a particular frame being sent down to that subscriber. Now, in the one-way dynamic addressing mode, the subscriber, by changing his address at the home terminal through the means of switches, is able to change his address. The computer is sending out on the order of perhaps 300, 600 frames over the appropriate time interval with an address coded in the vertical blanking interval, so that the subscriber in the home is able to avail himself of services such as library services and electronic mail, which we have demonstrated and are demonstrating at Reston. library services such as in the new community of Reston, we've made available information such as what meals are being served for lunch in the Reston community schools. It saves the child that age-old problem of eating the same meal for lunch as he had for supper. Rather far-out use, but you can see that the library services, one could conceivably use the home TV set and the computer as a data retrieval mechanism. Electronic mail means just what it says. Rather than sending mail hard copy through the post office, one could compose with a keyboard in the home. One could compose letters, one could receive letters via electronic means. Could I have the next slide, please? The two-way classes I've categorized into a limited two-way and a full two-way. I want to dwell primarily on the limited two-way. For purposes of discussion, I've categorized limited two-way. The key thing is the quantity of data being sent in the return path back to the computer. 100 bits is a typical number that the people in cable television are talking about as possibilities for response in the return direction. This would be sent back to a computer at a central point at a 1 megabit rate, or perhaps a 2 or 3 megabit rate over a video channel. Currently at Reston, the cable system in Reston, Virginia is owned by the Reston Transmission Company. Their system is not yet a two-way system. In Reston, we're using a telephone as the return path, which you'll again be seeing shortly in the film. The frame grabber decoder, which is used in conjunction with the telephone and the TV set in the home to make up the two-way interactive capability in the home, which we've called TICCIT, T-I-C-C-I-T, for Time Interactive Computer Controlled Informational Television, or interactive TV, is a frame grabber device, just as I discussed earlier in the case of dynamic addressing, used in conjunction with the telephone. We have demonstrated a home calculator service and a version of the tax filing assistance. Phyllis Thompson of the Internal Revenue Service has written a short program which we put on our demonstration system, which assists a person in filling out the standard deductions for tax filing. We've not implemented or attempted to implement the entire tax form. We're not competing with H&R Block in any sense of the word. Could I have the next slide, please? One of the questions that always comes up is, gee, this is neat, but how much does it cost? I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the costs. Just as a point of reference, 12-channel cable television systems, of which there are about 2,000 systems in the United States today, serving about 5 million subscribers, have typically cost on the order of $75 to $100 per subscriber. A modern 20-channel system, which would just meet the FCC rules and regulations that will be going into effect the 31st of March, we estimate would cost on the order of $125 to $150 per subscriber. The other numbers and the things that I'm passing over because of time limitations here, I've covered in more detail in the paper, which I believe many of you picked up, or if you haven't, you can pick up on your way out over in the corner. For the one-way dynamic addressing, the frame grabber decoder is available today for about $800. We're using as a refresh device a helical scan videotape recorder, a portable tape recorder made by the Sony Corporation. We chose the VTR as being a readily available device, as being a device that was going to appear in many homes based on the forecast videotape and video cassette revolution. This was about 2 years ago. It doesn't appear to us that this revolution is going to be coming at the rate that people were claiming it was going to be coming. We've looked at a number of other devices that could be used to implement the video refresh capability in the home. Image storage tubes made by a number of companies offer a possibility that fall in the price range between the $60 and the $800 that I've shown here. The $60 is really an estimate made by several of the manufacturers that MITRE has talked to, major semiconductor manufacturers. They feel that in about 1974 to 1976, through the magic of LSI chip technology, that in quantities, large quantities, 10,000 to 100,000, that a single frame alphanumeric refresh device should be available for the on the order of $60. The quantities are no problem if cable television goes the way it appears it's going to be going. The video tape recorder offers the capability for someone to store in his home successive frames. You notice here I referred to single frame. You can only store one frame. Another frame would wipe out the frame that you've stored. The VTR offers you the capability to store conventional television pictures. The LSI chip technology we're talking about, sending the alphanumeric information down, regenerating basically at the home subscriber terminal and then portraying it. Could I have the next slide, please? The price is still the same for the frame grabber, the decoder, frame stopper device in the case of limited two-way. The big difference I want to show you is this cost. As I've said a couple times, Reston is not a two-way system, Reston, Virginia. We're using telephone lines in return, a 12-button, push-button telephone, which comes free, except for monthly charges. Cable television operators are looking at, and perhaps the most notable example is an experiment being conducted in Los Angeles, California, right now by ThetaCom, which is a division of Hughes Aircraft, in conjunction with Teleprompter Corporation, which is the largest multiple system cable operator in the United States. They're looking at 12-button terminals to be used in the home, particularized for CATV, with costs on the order of $100 to $250 per subscriber. A much simpler home terminal, which would allow you to respond yes and no, would cost on the order of $50 to $100. Responding yes and no to questions such as, what did you think of this particular program? You've seen TV programs where they have the national driver's test. You